Welcome to Reading the Classics on KRBD. My name is Lisa Pearson with the Ketchikan Public Library, and this evening I'll be reading two short stories by the Irish poet and playwright Oscar Wilde. The Model Millionaire, a Note of Admiration. Unless one is wealthy, there's no use in being a charming fellow. Romance is the privilege of the rich, not the profession of the unemployed. The poor should be practical and prosaic. It's better to have a permanent income than to be fascinating. These are the great truths of modern life which Huey Erskine never realized. Poor Huey. Intellectually, we must admit, he was not of much importance. He never said a brilliant or even an ill-natured thing in his life, but then he was wonderfully good-looking, with his crisp brown hair, his clear-cut profile, and his gray eyes. He was as popular with men as he was with women, and he had every accomplishment except that of making money. His father had bequeathed him his cavalry sword and a history of the Peninsular War in 15 volumes. Huey hung the first over his looking glass, put the second on a shelf between Ruff's Guide and Bailey's Magazine, and lived on $200 a year that an old aunt allowed him. He'd tried everything. He'd gone on the stock exchange for 6 months, but what was a butterfly to do among bulls and bears? He'd been a tea merchant for a little longer, but had soon tired of Picot and Souchon. Then he tried selling dry sherry. That did not answer. The sherry was a little too dry. Ultimately, he became nothing, a delightful, ineffectual young man with a perfect profile and no profession. To make matters worse, he was in love. The girl he loved was Laura Merton, the daughter of a retired colonel who had lost his temper and his digestion in India and had never found either of them again. Laura adored him, and he was ready to kiss her shoestrings. They were the handsomest couple in London, and had not a penny piece between them. The colonel was very fond of Huey, but would not hear of any engagement. "Come to me, my boy, when you've got £10,000 of your own, and we'll see about it," he used to say, and Huey looked very glum on those days, and had to go to Laura for consolation. One morning, as he was on his way to Holland Park, where the Mertons lived, he dropped in to see a great friend of his, Alan Trevor. Trevor was a painter. Indeed, few people escape that nowadays. But he was also an artist, and artists are rather rare. Personally, he was a strange, rough fellow, with a freckled face and a red, ragged beard. However, when he took up the brush, he was a real master, and his pictures were eagerly sought after. He'd been very much attracted by Huey at first, it must be acknowledged, entirely on account of his personal charm. "The only people a painter should know," he used to say, "are people who are bête and beautiful, people who are an artistic pleasure to look at and an intellectual repose to talk to. Men who are dandies and women who are darlings rule the world. At least they should do so." However, after he got to know Huey better, he liked him quite as much for his bright, buoyant spirits and his generous, reckless nature, and had given him the permanent entree to his studio. When Huey came in, he found Trevor putting the finishing touches to a wonderful life-size picture of a beggar man. The beggar himself was standing on a raised platform in a corner of the studio. He was a wizened old man, with a face like wrinkled parchment, and a most piteous expression. Over his shoulders was flung a coarse brown cloak, all tears and tatters. His thick boots were patched and cobbled, and with one hand he leant on a rough stick, while with the other he held out his battered hat for alms. "What an amazing model!" whispered Huey as he shook hands with his friend. "An amazing model!" shouted Trevor at the top of his voice. "I should think so. Such beggars as he are not to be met with every day. A trouvaille, mon cher, a living Velasquez. My stars, what an etching Rembrandt would have made of him." "Poor old chap," said Huey. "How miserable he looks. But I suppose to you painters his face is his fortune." "Certainly," replied Trevor. "You don't want a beggar to look happy, do you?" "How much does a model get for sitting?" asked Huey as he found himself a comfortable seat on a divan. "A shilling an hour." "And how much do you get for your picture, Alan?" "Oh, for this I get 2,000. "Pounds?" "Guineas. Painters, poets, and physicians always get guineas." "Well, I think the model should have a percentage," cried Huey, laughing. "They work quite as hard as you do." "Nonsense, nonsense. Why, look at the trouble of laying on the paint alone, and standing all day long at one's easel. It's all very well, Huey, for you to talk, but I assure you that there are moments when art almost attains the dignity of manual labor. But you mustn't chatter, I'm very busy. Smoke a cigarette and keep quiet." After some time, the servant came in and told Trevor that the frame maker wanted to speak to him. "Don't run away, Huey," he said as he went out. "I'll be back in a moment." The old beggar man took advantage of Trevor's absence to rest for a moment on a wooden bench that was behind him. He looked so forlorn and wretched that Huey could not help pitying him and felt in his pockets to see what money he had. All he could find was a sovereign and some coppers. "Poor old fellow," he thought to himself. "He wants it more than I do, but it means no hansoms for a fortnight." And he walked across the studio and slipped the sovereign into the beggar's hand. The old man started, and a faint smile flitted across his withered lips. "Thank you, sir," he said. "Thank you." Then Trevor arrived, and Huey took his leave, blushing a little at what he had done. He spent the day with Laura, got a charming scolding for his extravagance, and had to walk home. That night he strolled into the Pallet Club about 11 o'clock and found Trevor sitting by himself in the smoking room, drinking hock and seltzer. "Well, Alan, did you get the picture finished all right?" he said as he lit his cigarette. "Finished and framed, my boy," answered Trevor. "And, by the by, you've made a conquest. That old model you saw is quite devoted to you. I had to tell him all about you. Who you are, where you live, what your income is, what prospects you have." "My dear Alan," cried Huey, "I shall probably find him waiting for me when I go home. But of course you're only joking, poor old wretch. I wish I could do something for him. I think it's dreadful that anyone should be so miserable. I've got heaps of old clothes at home. Do you think he'd care for any of them? Why, his rags are falling to bits." "But he looks splendid in them," said Trevor. "I wouldn't paint him in a frock coat for anything. What you call rags, I call romance. What seems poverty to you is picturesqueness to me. However, I'll tell him of your offer." "Alan," said Huey seriously, "you painters are a heartless lot." "An artist's heart is his head," replied Trevor. "Besides, our business is to realize the world as we see it, not to reform it as we know it. A chacun son métier. And now, tell me how Laura is. The old model was quite interested in her." "You don't mean to say you talked to him about her," said Huey. "Certainly I did. He knows all about the relentless colonel, the lovely Laura, and the 10,000 pounds. "You told that old beggar all my private affairs?" cried Huey, looking very red and angry. "My dear boy," said Trevor, smiling, "that old beggar, as you call him, is one of the richest men in Europe. He could buy all London tomorrow without overdrawing his account. He's a house in every capital, dines off gold plate, and can prevent Russia going to war when he chooses." "What on earth do you mean?" exclaimed Huey. "What I say," said Trevor. "The old man you saw today in the studio was Baron Hausberg. He's a great friend of mine, buys all my pictures and that sort of thing, and gave me a commission a month ago to paint him as a beggar. Que voulez-vous? La fantaisie du millionnaire. And I must say he made a magnificent figure in his rags. Or perhaps I should say in my rags. They're an old suit I got in Spain." "Baron Hausberg," cried Huey. "Good heavens, I gave him a sovereign." And he sank into an armchair, the picture of dismay. "Gave him a sovereign," shouted Trevor, and he burst into a roar of laughter. "My dear boy, you'll never see it again. Son affaire, c'est l'argent des autres." "I think you might have told me, Alan," said Huey sulkily, "and not have let me make such a fool of myself." "Well, to begin with, Huey," said Trevor, "it never entered my mind that you went about distributing alms in that reckless way. I can understand you're kissing a pretty model, but you're giving a sovereign to an ugly one? By Jove, no. Besides, the fact is, I was really not at home today to anyone, and when you came in, I didn't know whether Hausberg would like his name mentioned. You know, he wasn't in full dress." "God, what a duffer he must think me," said Huey. "No, not at all. He was in the highest spirits after you left, kept chuckling to himself and rubbing his old wrinkled hands together. I couldn't make out why he was so interested to know all about you, but I see it all now. He'll invest your sovereign for you, Huey, pay you the interest every 6 months, and have a capital story to tell after dinner." "I am an unlucky devil," growled Huey. "The best thing I can do is go to bed. And my dear Alan, you mustn't tell anyone. I shouldn't dare show my face in the row." "Nonsense. It reflects the highest credit on your philanthropic spirit, Huey. And don't run away. Have another cigarette. You can talk about Laura as much as you like." However, Huey wouldn't stop, but walked home, feeling very unhappy, and leaving Alan Trevor in fits of laughter. The next morning, as he was at breakfast, the servant brought him up a card on which was written, "Monsieur Gustave Naudin, de la part de Monsieur le Baron Hausberg." "I suppose he's come for an apology," said Huey to himself, and he told the servant to show the visitor up. An old gentleman with gold spectacles and gray hair came into the room and said in a slight French accent, "Have I the honor of addressing Monsieur Erskine?" Huey bowed. "I have come from Baron Hausberg," he continued. "The Baron," I beg, sir, that you offer him my sincerest apologies, stammered Huey. The Baron, said the old gentleman with a smile, has commissioned me to bring you this letter, and he extended the sealed envelope. On the outside was written, a wedding present to Hugh Erskine and Laura Merton from an old beggar, and inside was a check for £10,000. When they were married, Alan Trevor was the best man, and the Baron made a speech at the wedding breakfast. Millionaire models, remarked Alan, are rare enough, but by Jove, model millionaires are rarer still. The next story is The Sphinx Without a Secret, an etching. One afternoon, I was sitting outside the Café de la Paix, watching the splendor and shabbiness of Parisian life and wondering over my vermouth at the strange panorama of pride and poverty that was passing before me, when I heard someone call my name. I turned round and saw Lord Murchison. We had not met since we'd been at college together, nearly 10 years before, so I was delighted to come across him again, and we shook hands warmly. At Oxford, we had been great friends. I liked him immensely. He was so handsome, so high-spirited, and so honorable. We used to say of him that he would be the best of fellows if he did not always speak the truth, but I think we really admired him all the more for his frankness. I found him a good deal changed. He looked anxious and puzzled, and seemed to be in doubt about something. I felt it could not be modern skepticism, for Murchison was the stoutest of Tories, and believed in the Pentateuch as firmly as he believed in the House of Peers. So I concluded that it was a woman, and asked him if he was married yet. I don't understand women well enough, he answered. My dear Gerald, I said, women are meant to be loved, not to be understood. I cannot love where I cannot trust, he replied. I believe you have a mystery in your life, Gerald, I exclaimed. Tell me about it. Let us go for a drive, he answered. It's too crowded here. No, not a yellow carriage, any other color. There, that dark green one will do. And in a few moments we were trotting down the boulevard in the direction of the Madeleine. Where shall we go to? I said. Oh, anywhere you like, he answered. To the restaurant in the Bois. We'll dine there, and you should tell me all about yourself. I want to hear about you first, I said. Tell me your mystery. He took from his pocket a little silver-clasped Morocco case and handed it to me. I opened it. Inside there was the photograph of a woman. She was tall and slight, and strangely picturesque with her large, vague eyes and loosened hair. She looked like a clairvoyant, and was wrapped in rich furs. What do you think of that face? He said. Is it truthful? I examined it carefully. It seemed to me the face of someone who had a secret, but whether that secret was good or evil, I could not say. Its beauty was a beauty molded out of many mysteries. The beauty in face which is psychological, not plastic, and the faint smile that just played across the lips was far too subtle to be really sweet. Well, he cried impatiently, what do you say? She is the Gioconda in sables, I answered. Let me know all about her. Not now, he said, after dinner, and began to talk of other things. When the waiter brought us our coffee and cigarettes, I reminded Gerald of his promise. He rose from his seat, walked 2 or 3 times up and down the room, and sinking into an armchair, told me the following story. One evening, he said, I was walking down Bond Street, about 5 o'clock. There was a terrific crush of carriages, and the traffic was almost stopped. Close to the pavement was standing a little yellow brougham, which, for some reason or other, attracted my attention. As I passed by, there looked out from it the face I showed you this afternoon. It fascinated me immediately. All that night I kept thinking of it, and all the next day. I wandered up and down that wretched road, peering into every carriage, waiting for the yellow brougham. But I could not find my belle inconnue, and at last I began to think she was merely a dream. About a week afterwards, I was dining with Madame de Rastel. Dinner was for 8 o'clock, but at 8:30 we were still waiting in the drawing room. Finally, the servant threw open the door and announced Lady Alroy. It was the woman I had been looking for. She came in very slowly, looking like a moonbeam in gray lace, and to my intense delight, I was asked to take her in to dinner. After we had sat down, I remarked quite innocently, I think I caught sight of you in Bond Street some time ago, Lady Alroy. She grew very pale and said to me in a low voice, Pray do not talk so loud, you may be overheard. I felt miserable at having made such a bad beginning, and plunged recklessly into the subject of French plays. She spoke very little, always in the same low, musical voice, and seemed as if she was afraid of someone listening. I fell passionately, stupidly in love, and the indefinable atmosphere of mystery that surrounded her excited my most ardent curiosity. When she was going away, which she did very soon after dinner, I asked her if I might call and see her. She hesitated for a moment, glanced around to see if anyone was near us, and then said, "Yes, tomorrow at 4:45. I begged Madame de Rastail to tell me about her, but all that I could learn was that she was a widow with a beautiful house in Park Lane, and as some scientific bore began a dissertation of widows, as exemplifying the survival of the matrimonially fittest, I left and went home. The next day, I arrived at Park Lane, punctual to the moment, but was told by the butler that Lady Alroy had just gone out. I went down to the club, quite unhappy and very much puzzled, and after long consideration, wrote her a letter, asking if I might be allowed to try my chance some other afternoon. I had no answer for several days, but at last I got a little note saying she would be at home on Sunday at 4, and with this extraordinary postscript, 'Please do not write to me here again. I will explain when I see you.' On Sunday she received me and was perfectly charming, but when I was going away she begged of me, if I ever had occasion to write to her again, to address my letter to Mrs. Knox, care of Whitaker's Library, Green Street. 'There are reasons,' she said, 'why I cannot receive letters in my own house.' All through the season I saw a great deal of her, and the atmosphere of mystery never left her. Sometimes I thought she was in the power of some man, but she looked so unapproachable I could not believe it. It was really very difficult for me to come to any conclusion, for she was like one of those strange crystals that one sees in museums, which are at one moment clear and at another clouded. At last I determined to ask her to be my wife. I was sick and tired of the incessant secrecy that she imposed on all my visits, and on the few letters I sent her. I wrote to her at the library to ask her if she could see me the following Monday at 6. She answered yes, and I was in the seventh heaven of delight. I was infatuated with her, in spite of the mystery I thought then, in consequence of it I see now. No, it was the woman herself I loved. The mystery troubled me, maddened me. Why did chance put me in its track?" "You discovered it then?" I cried. "I fear so," he answered. "You can judge for yourself." When Monday came round, I went to lunch with my uncle, and about 4 o'clock found myself in the Marylebone Road. My uncle, you know, lives in Regent's Park. I wanted to get to Piccadilly, and took a shortcut through a lot of shabby little streets. Suddenly, I saw in front of me Lady Alroy, deeply veiled and walking very fast. On coming to the last house in the street, she went up the steps, took out a latchkey, and let herself in. "Here is the mystery," I said to myself, and I hurried on and examined the house. It seemed a sort of place for letting lodgings. On the doorstep lay her handkerchief, which she had dropped. I picked it up and put it in my pocket. Then I began to consider what I should do. I came to the conclusion that I had no right to spy on her, and I drove down to the club. At 6, I called in to see her. She was lying on a sofa in a tea gown of silver tissue looped up by some strange moonstones that she always wore. She was looking quite lovely. "I'm so glad to see you," she said. "I've not been out all day." I stared at her in amazement, and pulling the handkerchief out of my pocket, handed it to her. "You dropped this in Cumnor Street this afternoon, Lady Alroy," I said very calmly. She looked at me in terror, but made no attempt to take the handkerchief. "What were you doing there?" I asked. "What right have you to question me?" she answered. "The right of a man who loves you," I replied. "I came here to ask you to be my wife." She hid her face in her hands and burst into floods of tears. "You must tell me," I continued. She stood up and, looking me straight in the face, said, "Lord Murchison, there is nothing to tell you." "You went to meet someone," I cried. "This is your mystery." She grew dreadfully white and said, "I went to meet no one." "Can't you tell the truth?" I exclaimed. "I have told it," she replied. "I was mad, frantic. I don't know what I said, but I said terrible things to her. Finally, I rushed out of the house. She wrote me a letter the next day. I sent it back unopened and started for Norway with Alan Colville. After a month, I came back, and the first thing I saw in the Morning Post was the death of Lady Alroy. She had caught a chill at the opera and had died in 5 days of congestion of the lungs. I shut myself up and saw no one. I had loved her so much. I had loved her so madly. Good God, how I had loved that woman. You went to the street, to the house in it? I said. Yes, he answered. One day I went to Cumnor Street. I could not help it. I was tortured with doubt. I knocked at the door, and a respectable-looking woman opened it to me. I asked her if she had any rooms to let. Well, sir, she replied, the drawing rooms are supposed to be let, but I've not seen the lady for 3 months, and as rent is owing on them, you can have them. Is this the lady? I said, showing the photograph. Oh, that's her, sure enough, she exclaimed. And when's she coming back, sir? The lady is dead, I replied. Oh, sir, I hope not, said the woman. She was my best lodger. She paid me 3 guineas a week merely to sit in my drawing rooms now and then. She met someone here, I said. But the woman assured me that it was not so, that she always came alone and saw no one. What on earth did she do here? I cried. She simply sat in the drawing room, sir, reading books, and sometimes had tea, the woman answered. I did not know what to say, so I gave her a sovereign and went away. Now, what do you think it all meant? You don't believe the woman was telling the truth. I do. Then why did Lady Alroy go there? My dear Gerald, I answered, Lady Alroy was simply a woman with a mania for mystery. She took these rooms for the pleasure of going there with her veil down and imagining she was a heroine. She had a passion for secrecy, but she herself was merely a sphinx without a secret. Do you really think so? I am sure of it, he replied. He took out the Morocco case, opened it, and looked at the photograph. I wonder, he said at last. To finish off this evening, I'm going to read 3 short poems by Oscar Wilde. Impression du matin. The Thames nocturne of blue and gold changed to a harmony in gray. A barge with ochre-colored hay dropped from the wharf, and chill and cold the yellow fog came creeping down the bridges, till the houses' walls seemed changed to shadows, and St. Paul's loomed like a bubble over the town. Then suddenly arose the clang of waking life. The streets were stirred with country wagons, and a bird flew to the glistening roofs and sang. But one pale woman all alone, the daylight kissing her wan hair, loitered beneath the gas lamp's flare with lips of flame and heart of stone. Impressions. Part 1. Les Silhouettes. The sea is flecked with bars of gray, the dull, dead wind is out of tune, and like a withered leaf, the moon is blown across the stormy bay. Etched clear upon the pallid sand, the black boat lies. A sailor boy clambers aboard in careless joy with laughing face and gleaming hand. And overhead the curlews cry, where through the dusky upland grass the young brown-throated reapers pass like silhouettes against the sky. 2. La Fouille de la Lune. To outer senses there is peace, a dreamy peace on either hand, deep silence in the shadowy land, deep silence where the shadows cease, save for a cry that echoes shrill from some lone bird disconsolate, a corncrake calling to its mate, the answer from the misty hill. And suddenly the moon withdraws her sickle from the lightning skies, and to her somber cavern flies wrapped in a veil of yellow gauze. In the Gold Room, a harmony. Her ivory hands on the ivory keys strayed in a fitful fantasy, like the silver gleam when the poplar trees rustle their pale leaves listlessly, or the drifting foam of a restless sea when the waves show their teeth in the flying breeze. Her gold hair fell on a wall of gold like the delicate gossamer tangles spun on the burnished disk of the marigold, or the sunflower turning to meet the sun when the gloom of the jealous night is done and the spear of the lily is aureoled. And her sweet red lips on these lips of mine burned like the ruby fire set in the swinging lamp of a crimson shrine, or the bleeding wounds of the pomegranate, or the heart of the lotus drenched and wet with the spilt out blood of the rose red wine. Thank you for listening. This has been Reading the Classics with the Ketchikan Public Library. Have a good evening.